AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at Rubrik.com. That's Rubrik.com.
Off the ball. Rugby.
Yeah, the Barretts of Irish rugby, yeah.
Yeah.
And not from the school system as well.
Yeah, promising. Yeah, it's not all the same.
There's your X Factor, what? Stick down your X Factor pipe.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
The news round on Off the Ball. This is News Talk.
Good evening, you're welcome along to Monday night's Off the Ball. It's Owen here with you until 10 o'clock this evening. Coming up, we've got Monday Night Rugby. Coming up from 8 o'clock, Mike Sherry, Liam Toland will be with us to chat through Ireland's mediocre performance on Saturday, I think it's fair to say. After 9 o'clock, Richard Jolly will break down the weekend's Premier League action, and we'll also be hearing from the Shamrock Rovers camp after they secured the double against Cork City yesterday in the FAI Cup final. Our number is 0879 180 180 if you want to get in touch with us. We'll have Stephen Doyle with us in just a moment. Michael McCarthy, how are you?
I'm good, Owen. How are you?
All good. Like, you're deciding what's the top story from the weekend, and even if you like distill it down to the football, is it Shamrock Rovers yesterday? Is it Liverpool yesterday? Is it the wonderful 93rd minute equaliser from Sunderland on Saturday? I would say actually no.
Wonderful for all.
The Canadian Premier League's conclusion yesterday. You've seen this, right?
I haven't. I love finding out news on live on air.
I was only watching it before coming on. It's exactly what you might imagine the Canadian Premier League to be. It's like this snow-drenched setting that you could like have in FIFA 98, and they got rid of it because it was a completely useless video game concept. But you've got Atletico Ottawa up against Calvary FC. And in the middle of the worst conditions ever for football, where you can't even see the ball, this guy, Fernandez, produces one of the greatest bicycle kicks you're ever likely to see, where it's now been coined the icicle kick. And he would later go on to score the winner and secure the Canadian Premier League.
There you go. And there's Canadian teams in the MLS, isn't there?
Yeah, so
this is like real TNS stuff versus Barry Town in the Welsh Cup final, is it?
This is the real stuff, absolutely. This is... exactly what you'd expect from Canada. And even his second goal, between the equaliser and the winner, the snow had built up to the point where he could do a completely different celebration for his second goal, which was to jump into a pile of snow behind a goal that wasn't there for the first goal. So congratulations, everybody, at Atletico Ottawa.
Put out the bat signal there, Emma, for Kevin Kilbane tomorrow night's football show.
Did you notice one other thing on? I know it was the depths of winter, but there were so many players wearing gloves. The game is gone. The game was absolutely gone.
It's a slow storm.
I've digressed at a point to say good evening, Stephen Doyle. You're very welcome.
Thanks, Owen.
You were at arguably the main event in world football over the course of the weekend. You were commentating on Manchester City versus Liverpool yesterday.
Yeah, myself and Mr. Kerr. I have to tell you, Brian was just... Oh, he's a bundle of energy. Yes, he was delighted to be over there at the live match. And it was a great occasion. I'm going to go off the football point. I said this yesterday in the commentary. I think Manchester City have nailed pre-match entertainment, because we often complain about what goes on at the Aviva Stadium with the music drowning out the crowd and all that kind of stuff and killing the atmosphere a little bit. So this is what City do. Outside the stadium, they'll have a live band outside the stadium. So when we go in, pretty early, you know. So outside, you can still hear the music going, and you usually have local band playing all the local Manchester hits. They're banging out a bit of Oasis, Stone Roses, all that kind of stuff. Sometimes they'll have a DJ playing all the Hacienda classics. And it is great, because it really gets the atmosphere going outside the stadium, but they keep it outside the stadium. And then when people go in, they're still all, you know, buzzy after the entertainment outside. And then they get inside and they're waiting for the football. A really good way to do it.
Is it like concourse level sort of stuff?
Yeah, exactly that.
There's a bit of room around there, isn't it? Because it was a
massive
modern built stadium. So it's like they have an area to kind of make their own.
Yeah,
huge space. Like in the Aviva, really, or in Crow Park.
Yeah, definitely. There was a huge space. So it's, I don't know. There are places around the Aviva Stadium. Let me think now. Is the West Stand, is it? When you just arrived there, west or east?
Yeah, there's some room in there as you walk in. Yeah, less than Co Park.
But anyway, the game itself, I was expecting, you're kind of thinking Liverpool have turned a corner here, getting that win against Aston Villa last weekend, and then the performance against Real Madrid, and you're thinking, okay, they've got a couple of midfielders now playing well. Gravenberch and Alexis McAllister were looking good. You know, Salah had scored in back-to-back games. It just looked like things were coming together. Mamardashvili has looked okay for a man standing in for one of the best goalkeepers in the world. But right from the off, Manchester City just completely dominated them. And they did what Arne Slot doesn't like teams doing against them, and that's kind of sitting deep, creating a low block, and not allowing his attackers to try and, you know, score against them. And it was just really poor from Liverpool.
I missed the build-up to the game yesterday on Sky. Was it Mike Dean who was the referee who interjected for the equaliser on television?
Yeah.
But it just kind of comes out of absolutely nowhere.
Mike Dean pops out of nowhere. He did for the penalty as well.
Yeah, sorry, yes.
Doku was fouled. Yeah, it's just, they never tell you that Mike Dean... Well, I never watched the build-up from like 3 o'clock or whatever. But as far as I've ever seen, I've never been aware he's there until he's suddenly talking about the event. It's fine.
They've reduced his role, I think, a little bit to the point where he kind of pops up out of nowhere. I trust you didn't have a referee interjecting on your commentary when Virgil van Dijk nods to the bottom corner of Donnarumma's goal, do you?
Maybe we should bring over Alan Kelly or someone with us for the for the big games.
Were you up in arms about the call and commentary?
Yeah, Brian was straight out there. In fact, we were, and I think it's kind of gone, it's gone by the wayside because of the controversy over the goal, but the penalty kick awarded to Manchester City, I thought, was really soft as well. There wasn't a huge amount of contact there, and it was just
knocked them off balance.
Going a little bit, yeah. But
he missed them the first time, and then the other part of his leg grabbed
the
them.
Knee,
I thought it was one of those ones when it was given. It had to. Remain,
yeah, but know. The rule does say that if a player is interfering with the goalkeeper, now Donnarumma, he showed last week against Bournemouth because we did the Man City Bournemouth game last weekend. You know, this guy can be rattled. You know, he was rattled for the corner kick that Bournemouth scored from last weekend. And again, this is from a set piece. Like, Robertson wasn't in his eye line. He wasn't preventing him. Now, if you watch him again trying to make the save, he shifts to his right and then he has to dive to the left to try and save it. So he totally messed up his chance of trying to save the effort by making that shift to his right-hand side. So there was no way Robertson was putting him off there. Like, that was, it was a really bad call. We'll have it in the newsroom later. There's Liverpool have made their complaints known to the official body, but it was a bad call. Now, I don't know. Listen, we'll never know if it's going to have, if it had been given, would it have changed the game? But you'd have to say, the way City played for the rest of the afternoon, it wasn't going to change it.
That's where I would be as well. It felt like there was a sort of an ominous sense of one team being far better than the other. Were Liverpool going to just switch it on because it was suddenly 1-1 and they've had a penalty saved and a bit of momentum? You don't know. I suppose they're good enough to do it, but it just felt like they weren't set up to play against Man City yesterday. So we can take the idea of circumstances change the game. We all know that. We've all seen enough football to know it. But it does kind of belie reality a little bit, because City just seemed absolutely dominant. You know, like, even on commentary, in the television commentary, Gary Neville, before, you know, when there was 6 minutes injury time, was very much saying City really should go for this here because they're so on top. This is a chance to go. And they did exactly that. You know, there was, everyone could see there was a goal there, you know?
Yeah. Just one other thing quickly. I have been, talking to some Liverpool fans that I know who've been quite critical of Florian Wirtz. Everybody's been critical of him. I've been kind of holding counsel for a bit and just saying, right, we have to give this guy a good few games just to see how he settles in. And I do feel he's not being helped by his teammates by getting themselves into good positions to receive the ball. I do think he makes good runs. He gets himself into good positions. But my God, yesterday, like, we were close up to him in the second half because he was on our side of the pitch. And every time a City player came up to him, or two City players came up to him, like, you watch Doku, you know, going through two Liverpool defenders with the ball yesterday. Wirtz just couldn't do that. He just looked so physically outplayed by the opposition. It was really bad. Like, it just, I was kind of thinking, this doesn't look good.
How, like, the physicality thing, I understand the whole cliche, you're coming to the fastest, strongest league in the world and all that, but surely you've got to have something about you physically to be part of a literally unbeatable team in a whole Bundesliga season. Mm. Like, I'm not actually sure I buy the easy fix solutions to why Wirtz has been a flop so far. Like, I don't know what the answer is, but the idea that he's not strong enough or he's not able to hold his own, that just does not wash for me. I just struggle to actually comprehend that, but I haven't played Premier League football. Maybe it really is a complete level up in terms of grunt compared to the Bundesliga.
It's a lack of robustness, maybe is the word to use, robustness, because if you look at Phil Foden yesterday, Foden was absolutely sensational. I think it's a performance that maybe went under the radar a bit, and he's all over the pitch, and he's able to, whatever it is about his balance, and he's a similar shape and size to Florian Wirtz. He seems to be more robust in the challenge, and when another player comes to try and take the ball off him, he's able to hold him off better. Wirtz just doesn't seem to have that ability.
It's an interesting point Donald makes, though, because it is something that does seem to be the issue with him, or certainly an issue with him. But I wonder is, surely the sample size of his career, maybe he doesn't need it every week in the Bundesliga, or even in the Champions League, where we saw him play probably his best game for Liverpool on Wednesday night. But surely he's had games where that's been needed. And if you're going to pay, a ridiculous amount of money, what was it, 130 million or so for a player, then surely your due diligence is to make sure that you've seen him in that environment and you've seen whether he has that robustness or physical strength or toughness or whatever it might be in the big games against Bayern Munich or in whatever game it might. I'm sure he's played English teams in the Champions League and so on. And how has he performed at that level? Now, again, maybe he's just he hasn't settled into the team yet, and it's nothing to do with his physicality. That's just coming across because, things aren't set up well for him.
That's what I'm saying. He is quite slight. Or his teammates aren't helping him,
It's one of those things that's been, a spotlight's been shone on almost unfairly. There is that chance as well. But I also do question this, throwing a lot of money at people who've come and, regardless of what they've done in Germany, it isn't the same level as the Premier League at the moment.
No. The one other thing I'd say on Manchester City as well, last year when they were going through their really bad run of form, at the start we refused to accept that this run of form was going to continue because we got so used to Manchester City being dominant. I wonder, is the flip side of this happening? That we're going to be slow to realise that actually Manchester City are back because we still feel that there's a disappointing results about to happen?
Yeah.
A Tottenham turning them over, or who was it? Brighton turning them over earlier this year.
Villa only 2 weeks ago.
Villa only two weeks ago.
And see, that's the problem. So since they've played Spurs, they were well beaten by Spurs at the Etihad earlier in the season. And we were like, here we go again. They lost to Brighton the following week down at the Amex. But since then, we talked about it on Friday. Their results in the Champions League and in the Premier League at the Etihad have been unbelievable. They've been just absolutely casting teams aside. 3-1, 2-0, beating good teams really casually. Early wins, wrapped up at halftime, like basically this yesterday's one was. But their away form, I think we just have to wait and see, because they arguably didn't deserve to lose to Villa, but they didn't do enough. They created one chance in the whole game. And Villa Park's a hard place to go, don't get me wrong. It's not one of those, a lot of the big teams are going to struggle there, you would think. But at the same time, if City are back the way we're talking about, that's only a couple of weeks ago. Not like everything that happened bad to them was in August,
Their next game, St. James's Park, in a 5:30 kickoff right after the international break. So that'll be a good test. This is where we're starting this evening, Steve-O, on the Liverpool side of things and the unhappiness that they feel around that decision on the Van Dijk goal.
Yes, so it was revealed today Liverpool have made contact with the Professional Game Match Officials Limited body. The club has raised their concerns over the decision to disallow Virgil van Dijk's goal in Sunday's 3-0 defeat at Manchester City. City led 1-0 when the Red skipper appeared to have equalised with a header, but the effort was ruled out for on the field, a decision confirmed after a video assistant review. Andrew Robertson was in an offside position in the vicinity of goalkeeper Gianluigi Donnarumma and was deemed to have made an obvious action by ducking to allow the ball into the goal. The Anfield club does not accept, according to the wording of the rules, that the relevant criteria for an offence was met for referee Chris Kavanagh to disallow the Liverpool captain's effort in the 38th minute of the game. After the game, Liverpool boss Arne Slot was asked about the decision.
I would like to emphasise on the fact that being 2-0 down at half time was a fair reflection of how the game went. But I've been on the opposite side, that my team was much better than the other team. We were 1-0 up and then maybe not scoring the second one, and then the other team gets the set pieces 1-1, and then all of a sudden things change. So this can happen in football. It's not to say for me that it was a clear and obvious for me that it was a wrong decision that this goal was not allowed. But that doesn't, I will not say that because of that we've lost the game, because after 1-1, if City just kept on playing like they did, then we would have struggled in the second half as well. But I constantly felt if we are managing to keep maybe 1-0 down till halftime, we can maybe adjust a few things, which was definitely necessary because we were constantly coming one or two players short in the midfield, because Doku and O'Reilly gave us a lot of problems with the two of them.
I think that's pretty much well said. Like, there's nothing delusional in what he said there. And actually, I think as a complaint, I think he's done that very well. And I don't normally say that about managers you play here on a Monday, Steve-O. But the one thing I'll say about the controversy around it, I think it's clearly a goal. I don't think Robertson is interfering in play, so on. We've quickly turned it into VAR, have screwed everybody again. And it's like, one of the big points here is that the linesman calls that offside. Mm. That makes it, and because it's not your everyday offside with with the lines and so on, it's a subjective decision. It puts a lot of pressure on VAR to overturn that then.
That is true.
He is standing in line with the goalkeeper. From the other angle, from behind Van Dijk, say, it's kind of clear that Donnarumma can see. But at the same time, I just think it's a very different decision than if VAR overturned the goal and the linesman keeps his flag down. I don't think he does at all. So he says it's clear and obvious there. I think it probably on balance is, but I don't think it's as much a VAR mess up as perhaps it's been portrayed.
Yeah, no, I think that's an astute observation. Also as well, the peripheral vision of Donnarumma and all that is not something we can be sure about at that point. I initially thought at the start, there's absolutely no way they can chalk this goal off, but the more I've thought about it, maybe today it's...
Just quickly for balance, there will be, I'm sure, Liverpool supporters listening going, well, there's been VAR checks this season where goalkeepers have been clearly impeded or they've had players kind of knocking them out of position. And the goals have been allowed.
Usually hasn't been called offside on the pitch, though.
Yeah. And the thing is, then they'll also say, if the goal had been allowed, there probably wouldn't be too many complaints about it either. So, look.
Yeah, no, it's one of those. I really do. I'm not in any way arguing it. I just think that we're probably framing the argument wrong.
Good news. It is international break time. What's the latest on the fitness of Republic of Ireland striker Evan Ferguson?
Yeah, interesting story this one, Owen, because the Republic of Ireland assistant coach Sean O'Shea said today they're hopeful that Ferguson will be fit enough to play some part against Hungary on Sunday. The on-loan Roma striker has missed the last three club matches with an ankle injury and is definitely out of the World Cup qualifier against Portugal on Thursday. He has remained at Roma's Trigoria training base in Italy, and the medical staff there will continue to liaise with their Irish counterparts with a view to allowing the Meath man travel, if fit enough, ahead of the trip to Budapest. Roma announced today that another of their strikers, Artem Dovbik, injured his tendon and is out for the next 4 to 6 weeks. He joins Ferguson, Paulo Dybala and Leon Bailey on the treatment table. Now, Celtic striker Johnny Kenny and Hibernian midfielder Jamie McGrath were called up by Ireland head coach Hamer Hallgrimsson for the match against Portugal at the Aviva Stadium. The boys in green, of course, are a point behind the second-placed team, Hungary, in the group ahead of the final two matches of the campaign. Our own David Wilson put a couple of questions to captain Nathan Collins ahead of that game on Thursday evening.
We're one of the more serious players now in the squad. Probably haven't had that big standout home win. How much would it mean to you and the rest of the players that you can have a huge home win in front of the home crowd on Thursday against one of the big nations?
I think that's where the belief's coming from, and the faith we have in each other is that we know we can go get a big win against a top team. We've come close, obviously, in previous years against a few teams that we've not got over the line, but I think the belief in the squad is that Ireland at home has that in them to get a big win against a big squad, so why can't it be us, really?
I suppose in the last game it was good performance defensively, but there was not much kind of going forward. What are you going to change to try and score a goal against Portugal on Thursday?
Is that against Portugal or Armenia?
Sorry, against Portugal.
Yeah, listen, it's a different game, of course, away from home. It's always tough going to a place like that. You know, I felt we were under pressure a lot. They had a lot of ball. You know, it's not easy, but you have to just kind of bite the bullet with that. But when we're at home again, it's momentum, everything changes, they have a bit more pressure, the fans are not with them, they're against them, and it'll be a completely different game, I think.
Must say, I watched Nathan Collins' interview by the BBC at the weekend yesterday, when they won yesterday. It feels like 48 hours ago when they won for whatever reason. But like, he just really, naturally they just got a big win, really upbeat, and he was like saying, we want to make Brentford a sort of, oh, it's Brentford this weekend. And he kept using that expression, oh, it's Brentford this weekend, like really expressive in terms of what the identity of that team is, quite colourful almost in what he's saying. And it's just almost in the space of 24 hours, just a little turning down on the vibrancy and in what we're getting from.
Specific in his response, yeah, perhaps as well, yeah.
Look, at this stage, we've read into this so much that it could be you could play both of those things side by side to somebody who's not familiar with the Republic of Ireland story over the last 24 months and they wouldn't really notice the difference. But the Nathan Collins, even in front of a microphone, feels different for Ireland than the Nathan Collins in front of a microphone for Brentford.
It just has to be defensive, doesn't it? It's the psychological, I'm sure psychologists could look at that and answer you why, but I don't see how you could sit in front of the assembled press and not feel like, you know, oh, we're here to enjoy ourselves, we're, you know, everything's going swimmingly. You're just going to naturally be defensive, aren't you, because of the way things have gone.
The other thing is the Hungary-Armenia game is on before Ireland play Portugal, so that's going to have a massive bearing on what happens on Thursday night. Like, if Hungary beat Armenia, Ireland know they have to score against Portugal, so that defensive plan goes out the window, doesn't it?
And if the result goes the other way, they're probably going to need to get something from the game anyway.
Yeah, like, well, they're a point behind Hungary. If Hungary were to lose to Armenia and Ireland get a point, they're both level going into the game.
But then
a
draw won't be good enough in Hungary, given the fact that Hungary have a superior goal difference.
Yeah, it's not a huge difference in it, but yeah, it's, oh my God, I can't, but like, oh.
Listen, look, if Hungary beat Armenia, Ireland are done, because we'd have to, like, unless they win both games, if they get 4 points, they'll have to beat Hungary by 4 goals or something like that. So
we should say we don't need to get into this until like Wednesday, maybe. Thursday, I mean, before kickoff at the earliest. Because what we have is a team in World Cup action at the moment.
God.
Tomorrow, 1:30, Ireland-Paraguay.
Ireland-Paraguay. Ireland need a point to top the group. They beat Uzbekistan on Saturday after beating Panama 4-1, 2-1. I watched this game for the most part. I watched like a big chunk of it, most of the second half, and I know it's a 2-1 win against Uzbekistan, and any Ireland team in any era at any age group won't be like overly excited about it, but there's something buzzwordy about this team, Owen, and they play a nice brand of football. They're on the front foot nearly all of the time. And I'll tell you something, Michael Noonan. I've seen Michael Noonan play probably less than you, Steve-O, but I've seen him play maybe 8 to 10 games, you know, over the course of the last year or so for Shamrock Rovers. But seeing him play at his own age group, he's outstanding. Like, he just does everything you want the centre forward to do, you know. And he got the winner. He could have got a goal just beforehand, a lovely cross. Like, he didn't actually. The keeper just made an unbelievable catch off a cross that like was going straight onto his head, but just in the right places all the time. But his hold up play and his distribution and everything like that is fantastic.
Richie Tall was in last week making the point that this under-17s team is benefiting so much from a collection of them just playing first-team football.
Yeah.
The fact that Michael Noonan has been exposed to adult football for a good portion of this calendar year has really stood to him in terms of those moments as well.
I wouldn't even caveat the Uzbekistan thing, because I was talking to Brian Kerr about it yesterday, and he even said like they were a good team. Like,
they had beaten Paraguay in the first game and stuff, so it's not as if like they're arguably and likely going to be the second best team in the group.
Yeah. Fabio Cannavaro is their senior manager, so if that's
they're going to
sort
the
of a metric. That's the only double landlocked country to have ever qualified for the World Cup.
Oh, no, I've never heard that stat before. And who's the only double landlocked country in Europe?
The only other one in the world, you mean?
Oh, is it?
Oh, it's funny you should ask that question. The answer is Liechtenstein.
All right.
Yeah, Nicholas.
What's the only double landlocked county in Ireland?
Offaly.
No.
Longford.
No.
Leash.
Leash.
Good trivia.
Right. Midland listeners texting in anger now in the next few minutes.
Let's round up some of the football then. Massive day yesterday for Shamrock Rovers at the Aviva, Steve-O.
Yeah, Rovers celebrating a first league and cup double in 38 years on. The Hoops beat 10-man Cork City by 2-0 in the FAI Cup final at the Aviva Stadium. Rory Gaffney scored both goals for the winners in the second half. City played the second period with 10 men after Harry Nevin received a straight red card shortly before half-time. Rovers head coach Stephen Bradley stated after their historic win, there's no ceiling for his team.
When we won the Cup of Four, we were a team that was coming. We knew that we were coming, we knew that we were building. Today was all about achieving something that hadn't been done since 87 at this football club. And to do that with Europe in the mix is, for me, a special achievement from this group. And we sat down the first day of pre-season and that was the target. Domestic double and get out of the league phase of Europe.
Yeah, I mean, you can't really say anything other than that this being first step, or maybe the second step in terms of one of the great seasons from any Irish club ever. I think Stephen Bradley was speaking a couple of weeks ago and he said that if they managed to get out of the league phase of Europe and then add this trophy, which they did yesterday, it would be the best season by any Irish club ever, and it's kind of hard to disagree with that. I mean, I think, are the Cork fans up in arms with the red card yesterday? It's kind of hard to disagree with it being a red card.
And stupid red card, because what's annoying about it is that Cork showed up and probably had one of their best performances of the season and really frustrated Rovers and played very well, and they were making a cup final out of it, and they even did for long after the red card, but like, it just put them so under the cosh. Like, it was just so hard for them to do anything after that. And yeah, you got like the evergreen Rory Gaffney grabbing a couple, like that's a kind of a great story as well. Get him in the Ireland squad, obviously, you know, the usual calls will happen. But
Gaffney's the second finish from Gaffney was absolutely outrageous.
Beautiful.
Yeah. Some player.
But it's mad. It's a mad thing, Shamrock Rovers' relationship with this competition, because like, they had dominated it for basically since the start of from the 1920s all the way through to winning three in a row, the three doubles in a row in 1987, and then stopped, and it became a massive Achilles heel. They won it in 2019, but like, they're barely even making finals. Like, you know, they're hardly ever in the FAI Cup final. So this was a really big deal to win this. So this is a big deal for this club and for Stephen Bradley, and he was, you know, they did not put out every player that they wanted to, that, you know, in Athens, in one of the most, possibly one of the best, 2 minutes away from the best Irish European result of all time, possibly. And they rested a couple of players for the cup final. That's how much it meant.
Yeah. He said he's going to let them off the leash, as he said there.
The Ike Athens performance and result was sensational, because I was doing a good bit of research on that Ike team last week, and it's just littered with internationals, like a really, really good side. And for Rovers to go out, and like, the only changes that he did make a lot of changes. He kept his back three and goalkeeper. Lee Grace ended up playing that match with, you know, a bit of a knock. Just to hold them to a 1-1, never mind. Granted, it would have been better if they got the 1-0, but even to get that 1-1 in Greece, absolutely unbelievable. And, you know, no doubt they went out to the Aviva Stadium as well yesterday thinking, let's do our pals over in Fisborough big favour here by...
Yeah, definitely. That was the big thing for them. They all went around with like green, white, black and red scarves at the end of the game. You know, a double win for Dublin. What an amazing night. Which was actually just mentioned when I was saying about Cork there. If McGinty doesn't make that save right before, like about what, 3 minutes before Gaffney scores the first goal. If that, like, that was an unbelievable save. And if it goes 1-0 and they're hanging on, 10 men behind the ball, you never know.
Yeah, absolutely.
We have one other League of Ireland story here, Steve-O.
Dundalk confirmed that the club has changed hands with majority shareholder John Temple's 65% stake acquired by Chris Clinton, who is based in the United States. Clinton has stepped in as club chairperson and will appoint a new management board in the coming days. The Lilywhites won this season's first division and are currently in the process of upgrading their facilities at Oriel Park. First team manager Kieran Kilduff recently committed his future to the club by signing a 2-year deal to stay on as boss.
Right, that is pretty much it when it comes to football news today, but still loads more to come on tonight's Monday news round. We've got rugby coming up next.
Off the Ball on News Talk.
Welcome back to Monday night's news round. It's Owen and Michael McCarthy and Stephen Doyle in studio. Steve-O, where are you taking us next?
Well, Rugby Next own and the Connacht pair Mac Hansen and Darren Murray have been called up to the Ireland squad ahead of the Autumn Nations Series test against Australia. Hansen is making a good recovery from a foot injury, but Jamie Osborne has been ruled out for the rest of the series with a shoulder knock. Lock forward Murray was capped during the summer tour and has played 42 times for the Westerners. Gary Ringrose and Josh Van der Fleer are both nursing hamstring strains ahead of Saturday's game. They'll be assessed during the week, while Stuart McCloskey is expected his training this week. He, of course, has been dealing with a groin problem. The glaring statistic from Ireland's win against Japan at the weekend was 57% of Ireland's own lineouts won. The former Ireland international Alan Quinlan was on with the lads on the Off the Ball breakfast show, and he believes it's down to the calling of the lineout.
Of course, it's still a problem, and it was a problem in the game the other day. But not, I wasn't as frustrated, you know, as I probably other games. Again, two lineouts losses in one game could frustrate me more if they were, do you understand what I mean? If there were poor calls and poor execution, I think there's definitely two there, isn't there, the other day that's just completely wrong calls. People make mistakes. It doesn't excuse it, but yeah, it's still a problem. And it's having a dominant lineout leader, caller, and we don't have that. What you do, you just have to keep working on it and try and come up with, you know, keep going, really. I just think that there's lineouts we're winning the other day, and a lot of them, you're winning them at the front. You know, you're kind of... It's very difficult to get Ireland's attack going these days, and they need quality ball from their lineout towards, from the middle and the tail of the lineup.
Yeah, we'd have loads on this with Mike Sherry, a former Munster hooker, after 8 o'clock, who is an expert on the lineout. So we might park the lineout stuff there.
You know whose fault it never is on?
The hooker?
As a former hooker myself.
Yeah. Okay, good to know in advance of 8 o'clock.
Oh, how jumpers. Were your darts back in the day?
Absolutely shocking. It was very early in my rugby career, which coincidentally was also very late in my rugby career. And, my line-out throne wasn't the best. To be honest, like, you'd have a call of like 2, 4, 6 back then in very simple terms, you know, so you'd have letters basically at the end of a load of random letters you'd say, which would determine which one it would go to. Let's just say I never called 6. Okay. I may as well have forgot the word for all it mattered.
When it comes to this Ireland performance on Saturday, things are very negative, aren't they? Like it's more negative than the previous week against New Zealand. And like I was watching it, and I'm trying to think of, like, we keep using the phrase mitigation, like in every kind of thing when it comes to rugby at the moment, even when it comes to explaining somebody's form. And I'm thinking of those instances of mitigation, and I'm like, well, they've made a host of changes. This is a team that's never played with each other before. Sure, the vast majority of the team have barely played for Ireland. And then I'm like, actually, probably 8 of these players are probably first choice starters.
Yeah, he probably kept like a stronger team than would usually start the fourth of the, you know, the level four of the four games that you play. You know, they've played against like Fiji and so on with lesser teams than this, and put in, it's a normal performance, I would say, for Ireland against the sort of second ranked teams. That's what they always do. They struggle a little bit, eventually they have too much for them and run in a lot of tries. It's an unimpressive performance. I don't think it speaks to a crisis. Again, if everything didn't happen the week before, I think there is some genuine mitigation in that, you know, the squad were in Chicago last week. You know, you're playing 7 days later in Dublin. You're playing at the most ridiculous time of day that I've ever, like, the atmosphere was dead.
Oh, Japan have to play that as well.
Dodo. Yeah, of course they do, yeah, but that's fine. Like, but Japan are up for playing against Ireland. That's one of their big, you know, the team they beat in 2019. Can we get a, you know, Eddie Jones doesn't like the scummy Irish. Of course he does, it's only a joke.
Yeah.
And so on. You know, so I'm not saying anything excuse it. I just don't care about it, because I don't think it's going to factor into what happens next week.
Eddie Jones said afterwards that Ireland are a team in transition. I don't think anybody's really said that within the Ireland camp to that extent. But it's important that that's on the record, I think.
Transition to what?
Yeah.
Well, that's my concern.
Who are the players coming behind the ageing players in the squad? That's what I'd wonder.
Well, it's the now injured Jamie Osborne. Mm. And I think even then we've seen him play 2 games in a position that's not his optimal position. Yeah. So could you say that was opportunity wasted with Osborne? I'm not saying that you would necessarily do anything different with him because Keenan was always going to be out of this, but it feels like that's a bit of a missed opportunity to see him at 12. You're talking about the 27-year-old Tommy O'Brien. Granted, it's the reason why he's so late onto the scene in an Ireland jersey is because of injuries. And he's been sublime. He's been the story of the window so far. You're talking about Paddy McCarthy getting his first try. The problem is that the next best new player who looks really, really good is Gus McCarthy, and there's two brilliant players in front of him.
Yeah,
so,
who are also young, yeah.
Clarkson obviously got out there again at the weekend. Beyond that then, you're talking about newer players in the guise of Timoney and Cian Prendergast.
Stockdale. None of whom are young.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, transition to what is a very good question, and I'm not sure I want to know the answer.
Yeah, Craig Casey starts as well and, you know, gets immortal. You know, we are in a Conor Murray-less world in terms of professional rugby at the moment, so you need to see, like, at the moment, Craig Casey needs to be playing games for Ireland and getting up to speed on that. So, yeah, it's... If you come out in November, though, with Tommy O'Brien and Paddy McCarthy established as international players, you know, you'll have a Joe McCarthy coming back for the Six Nations. I think James Ryan has played quite very well, actually, you know, and you line out issues aside and the technicalities of in open play, and you know, there's competition for places and stuff like that. There's positives if you look for them. I think what we all just generally feel is a sense that things are not firing on all cylinders, and there's a malaise there that would worry you heading into a tough game this weekend and an almost impossible game the week after.
Yeah, I just think sometimes the word transition is a dirty word in sport.
Yeah, and it's okay maybe to be in transition.
Yeah, exactly. Like, we absolutely are.
Cool.
And that's okay, but sometimes when it's said out loud, you kind of take a sharp and take a breath and you're like, oh my God, somebody said that word out loud.
Did you see the Sia Khaleesi interview and Matt Field and Steinman interrupting it and lifting him up on the shoulders and bringing him for a lap of honour?
Missed that.
I missed that because I was watching it on TNT.
Oh, it must
have been a different from a different broadcaster.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah, I just saw it on social media afterwards. So he was just doing an interview, and it was his 100th cap, obviously. And the two boys just came over and just, without him knowing, just lifted him up onto their shoulders and just brought him on a lap of honour. But it was just a really nice moment as well, because I don't think there's many greater sportsman than Sia Khaleesi over the course of our lifetimes anyway. So I just think the recognition he's getting at the moment is so worth it. And looks like he's going to be there in 2 years to lift the third World Cup, perhaps.
was that just a flex from Rassi? Take him off just to show them that we can win without our captain?
Yeah. Well, see, that's the thing about Khaleesi, though. He's so much a on-field coach and stuff as well. Like, they regularly, you know, play without him, I suppose, even when he is lasts a bit longer at 60 minutes. But yeah, I think so. I think there's a little bit of he'd want to lose his form completely to lose his place more than anybody else.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair. What's next, Steve-O?
Yeah, just notes here on the late Barry McGann, who sadly passed away on Saturday, age 77. The RFU paid tribute to the former international today. McGann won the first of his 25 caps in 1969, playing for Ireland until 1976. He was also a talented footballer, featuring for Ireland at underage level, while he also lined out for Shelburne. Corkon president Ralph Keyes hailed his genius on the rugby field. I'm also reliably told he played for an Irish underage football team that defeated the Netherlands and a Dutch team with a young Johan Cruyff in it.
Okay. Mm. Jeez, that is a hell of a sporting legacy then. On to the athletics and a new record being set.
Yeah, Donegal's Catriona Jennings setting a new women's 100-mile, yes, I said 100-mile world record at the Tunnel Hill event in the United States. It was her first ever attempt at the distance. The Tunnel Hill 100 mile is an ultra marathon event held on a scenic trail in Illinois. Her time of 12 hours, 37 minutes. And hang on, I have got this right, haven't I?
Yeah, that's 12, surely.
I'm confusing myself now.
That's 12 days.
It's 12 and a half hours.
12 and a half hours, yeah. 12 hours, 37 minutes and 4 seconds beat the previous record by over 5 minutes. An average 7 minutes 34 per mile across 160.9 kilometres. She was speaking to Ciara Doherty on News Talks, The Hard Shoulder, about the mental task she prepared for.
I was concerned about the mental side of it nearly more than the physical side, because I knew I was going to be on the course for probably, like, you know, 13 to 14 hours or, you know, something around that region of time, which is a long time to be in your own thoughts. I think I just broke it up into different distances and tried to just stay in that moment and stay positive about the distance, you know, that block you were in at the time, and then just kind of ticking it off and ticking it off. And, you know, it was actually, it was, you know, it might sound crazy, but it was a bit easier than I thought it would be. That, you know, once you have the, I think once you're prepared that you're going to need those mental kind of crutches, it does actually help them when you're there on the day.
Yeah. Just imagine being somebody who's like, I'm nationally famous for running marathons. What am I going to turn my attention now that, you know, the end of my athletic career is nigh? I'm going to start running 100 mile races. It's just, these people are absolutely crazy and unbelievable. Like that, looking at that there, because I mean, I think that's about like 4:42 per kilometer, the 7:34 per mile in terms of her pace. And to do that over the course of 12 and a half hours.
I wonder if any lads kind of doing charity 100 mile runs like in a mascot outfit.
Yeah. Yeah, we never
dressed
got
up as an ostrich or a big
Leo the Lion
or something.
That was actually that was one of the most uncommented upon pieces after the Dublin Marathon, was just how fast Leo the Lion is.
Well, like, not a few Leo the Lions.
Oh, was there a few of them?
Leo's the Lion.
Yeah.
I've suggested that Leo the Lion was more than one person before and got into some trouble about it now, so I wouldn't know.
I've got a good Leo the Lion story, actually. Was it 2012 when Leinster played Ulster, the Champions Cup final in Twickenham?
Yeah.
And at halftime, I was there reporting on that match, and at halftime, I'm not sure if the EPCR still do it, but the mascots always came on to have a kicking competition. So they take three penalties or three kicks from the 22-metre line, and out comes Leo the Lion and Ulster's. Ulster had, they have this dog. I can't think of the name of the dog. And anyway, Sparky the dog. Yeah, so Sparky
comes
out. Oh, he's a bear, is he? I thought he was a dog.
Sparky the dog, so he's a bear. What?
So Leo the Lion comes out and he's like limbering up. And Leo the Lion has his outfit on, but he's got like a pair of, like, it looks like Predator boots on him. But Sparky's got his, like, big novelty bare feet. Leo the Lion was, like, smashing these kicks right through the crossbar. And poor old Sparky comes up with his novelty bare feet. He's hardly kicking the ball about 5 or 10 metres. It was unbelievable. It was one of the funniest things I've ever seen.
So, but this is 2012. But,
2012, wasn't it? I think.
So 8 years ago, Norman Pollock, a.k.a. Sparky, to retire from mascot duties, was a headline on the Ulster Rugby.
Because of how crap he was.
It had all come to a head. And then Ulster Rugby advertised a vacancy for somebody to get into the new costume on the 19th of June 2018. So did anybody get this job? I wonder.
Must have a pair of boots.
Hell of a weekend, by the way, for the mascots in England and across the UK, having to do their thing for, you know, poppy season and all that.
Is that website
still there? There was a Twitter account, wasn't there, about
mascots minute silence.
Yeah. Standing attention to minute silence.
Poor old Katrina Jennings, though. She broke the world record at 100 miles, and we've segued into a conversation about mascots.
Slight digression there. You have Gaelic Games next, Steve.
Nafina out of the Leinster Club Hurling Championship after a 1-point defeat to St Martins of Wexford yesterday. The reigning provincial and All-Ireland champion suffered a 121-217 defeat at Wexford Park. Meanwhile, Ballyhale Shamrocks manager Henry Shefflin was among those to condemn the scenes at the end of his side's win over Kilcormac Colahy of Offaly. Players were involved in a melee after the full-time whistle, with the fan also entering the playing field. Gardaí later confirmed a man in his 40s was arrested. Monaghan champion Scotstown progressed to the Ulster Club football semi-finals courtesy of a 216-16 point win over Nave Connell of Donegal and Clonus yesterday. Newbridge of Derry also advanced after their 18-12 win over Madden of Armagh. In Connacht, Galway's Moy Cullen beat Shamrock Gales of Sligo by 120-19, while Éire Óg of Clare got the better of Rathcormac of Waterford by 20-113 in Munster. The reigning All-Ireland Women's Club football champions Kilcairn Clonbrook Kilburn are through to another All-Ireland semi-final. The Galway club retained the Connacht crown yesterday with a 3-21-9 win over St. Bridget's of Roscommon, and Kilmacud Crokes won a fourth Leinster crown in a row after their 5-13-1 win over Tinahili of Wicklow.
I kind of get the feeling that these crazy scenes in Club GAA are kind of a thing of the past. And I think we've got greater coverage of all the games that are happening around the country now. So if anything is happening, we tend to find out about them more than we would have done 10 years ago, for example. But even then, yesterday was like just, I was going to say, like there was a summer of like 2018, I think it was, or a winter of 2018, where this stuff was happening every weekend. And yesterday felt like a bit of a throwback to that.
Yeah, and it was a fairly shocking thing as well, because obviously I think most of us saw it in clip form and you're kind of seeing its players involved. And then a fan kind of arrives from nowhere, and that fan is not holding back in the way that the players obviously are, trying not to be sent off and so on. So it's just a grim enough thing. I will say that if you look at it, the Kilcormac Clahy players fairly quickly recognise what's happening and do everything they can to, you know, get him out of there, for want of a better expression. So at least there's that. Yeah, it didn't seem like any of the players did anything in any way egregious or terrible. But yeah, it is. It's funny you say that, Owen. I don't know. I feel like I've seen more clips in the last few weeks than I've seen in a while of these kind of things happening. But I think I am just trying to temper that with what you said there. We do have access to every club match in the country. Is one way or another filmed, and that can find its way onto social media very, very quickly. So in the past, there were no cameras for a lot of these things. It doesn't mean that we've gone off the deep end or anything.
Yeah, for sure. We have time for one last story, Steve-O.
Yeah, Rachel Blackmore has taken up a new role with the Cheltenham Festival as the head of Ladies' Day. The Tipperary native, who was a Cheltenham Gold Cup winning jockey in 2022, will look to encourage more women to come racing. A Ladies' Day will return to the festival schedule in 2026, having last taken place in 2019.
All right, Stephen Doyle, thank you very much for Monday's news round.